Paul Matthews is our tech correspondent, and a very good morning to you, Paul.
G'day, Catherine. How are you?
I'm good, thanks very much. Really keen to hear more about this new data centre region in New Zealand that Microsoft has announced, please.
Yeah, it's quite big news actually for New Zealand, because it's the first of the really big players to actually set up in New Zealand. And up until now, they're being hosted from primarily Sydney, but further afield as well. So it's quite big news. Now, Microsoft's, as you say, has announced a new data centre region. Now, a region isn't just a data centre, and what they'll be doing is building up to essentially a cluster of data centres. So you'd expect to see two or three geographically spread, big server farms effectively. They'll each be on separate power. They'll be far enough away so there isn't earthquake or any other sort of natural disaster. It doesn't take them all out and gives some decent amount of redundancy. Now, the level of investment, I mean, this is tens of millions of dollars, so it's not just putting up a building and putting some servers in there. It really is a significant investment into infrastructure in New Zealand. And as I say, it's the first of the really big players to establish here, which is actually really good.
Why are we attractive to them?
I think a couple of reasons. Now, Microsoft's cloud services, their public cloud, which is Microsoft Azure, of course, is growing really, really fast for a start. So they currently hold about 30% of the public cloud market. Amazon Web Services is the leader at the moment. They're sitting on around about 40%. And there's a really big long tail of other providers. Google Cloud's in there at a few percent, and then lots of others. But so there's two things. One is they're growing, and with that, they need to continue to invest in their infrastructure. You know, the other thing is that, you know, New Zealand is a really attractive place to host some of these things. We have very good power here. Our power is generally renewable, or a large portion of it is at least, and we have quite good connectivity with the rest of the world, which is good. We do have some other factors, I guess, that have played into the decision, or potentially played into the decision. In Australia, a year or two ago, they implemented what's known as their backdoor law, which is the Telecommunications Assistance and Access Act. And what it effectively does is forces tech companies to provide a backdoor for the Australian government and encryption. Now, as you'll know from the big hoo-ha over Zoom, end-to-end encryption is actually really important. And end-to-end basically means that if I send a file to you, or we have a video conversation or whatever, it's encrypted at my end, decrypted at your end, and nobody along the way, including the company who hosts it, can actually access it. And this law in Australia basically goes against that and says, well, no, you've got to provide a way that we can listen in to encrypted calls, that we can access encrypted files. And it kind of breaks the whole encryption model. So, you know, that's led to some things. For example, parliamentary services here, they paused a really big push to move everything to Office 365, which is the Microsoft's cloud office suite. Following this law, that's on hold at the moment, and lots of other concerns. So, you know, I could almost see the funny situation where data is hosted here for Australia rather than the other way around.
There may be a push, though, given we have strong security partnerships, including with Australia. Might there be a push for us to look at our legislation?
Absolutely. And that's, I think, what we've got to watch out for. I mean, absolutely, law enforcement has a job to do, and we have to support them doing it. But when they do things like force back doors, you know, it's not just used by the good guys. And we talked about this a while ago in the context of viruses. You know, when a back door is created, that's great. The good guys, if you want, can listen in. But it also provides an attack vector, or a place that the bad guys can go and access that as well. So it's just really a bad thing. And most of the tech sector were pretty horrified when Australia proposed this and put it in place. It's really not a good thing for everyday people and their privacy.
I just wanted to finish the whys and the wherefores. The physical infrastructure, do you want them geographically spread around the world? I mean, why don't they just all have them in a desert in Arizona or somewhere? Like, what's the attraction geographically to being down under?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is that it will reduce lag and bring a lot more processing closer to home for New Zealand. So you know, these days we're dealing with artificial intelligence and massive amounts of data. So transporting data backwards and forwards from those data centres is actually quite a big thing. Now, we only have a relatively small, hop to Sydney. The time can be measured in milliseconds in terms of how fast we can get data from Sydney data centres, but it is still a lag, and that does make a difference. So, you know, in terms of serving up to New Zealand, it makes good sense for them to invest. They've got something like, I think it was 56, I may have that number wrong, but 56 data zones or regions kind of around the world already. So their model, and the model of cloud computing, is that you grow these things, you do it in a way that data can be stored locally, because that's really important, but you also do it in a way where you have a lot of redundancy. So if something happens in one country, you know, there's nothing to say, for example, and you know, this has come about, you know, people are thinking about this a lot more with the whole COVID-19 stuff. You know, what would happen if our connection to the rest of the world was chopped? Now, that's not completely out of the earth sort of idea. It could happen one day. So this type of things just gives New Zealand a significant amount of resilience if something like that were to happen, and especially with companies who are putting their core systems in the cloud these days.
Couple more questions before I let you kick on. They big physical structures? Like, what do they look like?
Yeah, they are. They vary in design, but effectively they're like a really, really big warehouse with lots and lots and lots of servers sitting in it. It's all very temperature controlled, high security access controlled. They don't always give you a lot of detail about where they're hosted, how many people work for them. Amazon, their main competitor, is very famous for never letting anybody know how many staff are in each country, where they place their data centers. So there's a lot of smoke and mirrors about it for security reasons, but basically like a really, really big warehouse, and filled up with servers and temperature and everything maintained very closely.
Good luck hiding where they are here, frankly. But anyway, and the energy needs is.
We tried to hide a spy station at one station, and then somebody got in. And
the other thing is the energy use is really important, because I can't put my finger on it now, but I did notice researching not too long ago that one of the biggest growing energy demands by far, and the energy take around the world, is of course these servers. So, at the moment we're wondering what happens if TY goes, and we've had the increase in demand pretty flat for electricity anyway for some years now. But we do anticipate that changing if the conversion to electric vehicles picks up pace. And do we need to think about how much energy, how much electricity this might need? Also, how we charge for it.
Yeah, well, that's right. And you would think that they'd be in that group of electricity users that can sort of negotiate their own rates, like the aluminium smelter down south. But they don't use as much power as an aluminium smelter. I don't know if anything does. They use a heck of a lot down there, but they do use a lot of power. And I think one of the other attractions with New Zealand is the fact that so much of our power is renewable. And again, part of their model, as with most companies these days, is looking to ensure that they're minimising their footprint on the environment. So it's certainly attractive, placing this somewhere that has a primarily renewable electricity supply.
It's about 13 or 15% of our total electricity supply goes to TY, I think. So that's a chunk. It's a chunk now, and it's a chunk missing if the smelter ultimately closes. And one wonders if that's partially what people have got in mind as well, what the future might look like.
Well, it's not going to be there forever, is it? At the end of the day.
So, all right. Kick on with its significance to other players here.
Yep. So, we have some local players in the cloud space as well, and they kind of have their own, their own market. I wouldn't say they're a niche player, because they're actually quite big, but people like Catalyst Cloud, you might know Catalyst IT. They set up a cloud or a number of cloud farms a few years ago. So that's kicking off, and they've been a really good go-to for people who wanted to ensure that their data was stored within New Zealand. I think on the larger scale, I'd expect that AWS, Amazon Web Services, will probably follow in the next year or two. And I think that's really a good thing for New Zealand. One thing we also need to be aware of is, Yeah, the data sovereignty debate. So that's talking about whose laws apply and where your data is based. So if you've got data, it's stored in the US, for example, do American laws apply to that data and retrieval of that data, or New Zealand laws? And it's a bit of a challenge. You know, the Privacy Act, or Privacy Bill as it is currently, that's working through Parliament, tries to address that to some extent. But, you know, the USA has a thing called the Cloud Act. And what that does is it says, actually, we don't care where the data is held. If it's an American company and it's established and operating within America, they have to give us access to data wherever it's hosted around the world. So, you know, so some people are saying, well, that's good that they've got the data center here. That's well and good, and it's got some benefits to it. But it doesn't get over the sovereignty issue, because the US and China's the same. But the US can essentially just reach in and access the data that they'd want to anyway.
So what might that mean for the popularity of where people keep their data? Like, what how might that affect decisions?
I think people have generally accepted that that's the reality. If you're storing something that's highly, highly, highly confidential, don't put it on the internet is the short answer. Don't put it in the cloud. You know, you have to accept the fact that as soon as you put something on the internet, and cloud computing is no different to this, you have to assume that it's at some point or other somebody could be looking at that. And, you know, your companies do offer forms of end-to-end encryption, you know, without going into the technical detail. You can store stuff on the internet that nobody except you can access, because you hold the key to it. But, you know, you just have to make that assumption. And I think, by and large, most companies who would be using these sorts of services have accepted that that's one of the downsides to it. And you know, the rise in popularity, not just with Microsoft Azure, but across the board, kind of indicates that that's the point.
What are the odds of the Australian government getting Google and Facebook to pay up? How are you reading this?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one, and it's been brewing for a little while. But effectively, the short version is the Australian government's announced that they've had enough, and they're going to get Google and Facebook to fund traditional media stories that they link to. Now this isn't the first time it's been tried. You know, they had a crack in Europe as well. Spain tried something similar with Google News. So Google just removed the news service from Spain. You know, France tried with the changes to the copyright law. That was all well and good, but Google then just removed text snippets from news stories and again refused to pay. So you know, there is a bit of a history here, but the Australians, the approach that they're taking is more from a competitive law perspective and an antitrust style perspective. So this is a little bit different from what's been tried before. Google and Facebook, of course, who are the big ones, don't like it. They say that they, yes, they get the lion's share of advertising revenue, but they also provide the eyeballs to traditional media, and it is a symbiotic relationship. You know, traditional media these days need Google and Facebook to get their stories out there. Google and Facebook, especially Google, would be nothing if they didn't have content they could link to. So what the Australians are trying to do is say, well, you both benefit from this arrangement. You haven't been able to sort it out yourself. Therefore, it's a market failure, so we're going to step in. Now, there's a couple of ways of looking at it. The first way is to say, well, okay, fair enough. That's, you know, they haven't played fair. The other side of it is to say, well, is this actually just another example of a broken business model with traditional media? You know, there are some other things they're trying around, you know, different people are trying around things like paywalls and even donation, where we saw from stuff relatively recently. So is it an example of a broken model? But, you know, I think where the media sort of steps up above other industries is the public good component, and it's actually really essential that we have an independent, reasonably well-funded public good media who are there to hold the government and the country as a whole to account. So, you know, it's a complex situation. It's not as simple as Uber, for example. You know, the Aussies are currently making every Uber ride fund $1.10 into a big fund for the taxi industry, because it's effectively displaced them. But I think this is a little bit different, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Has anyone achieved it elsewhere in the world?
No, they've tried. And as I say, Spain, France, the European Union as well as a whole tried to change copyright law, actually, that that basically said, look, if you're using the title, the link, and a snippet of text, then you have to enter into an arrangement and pay for that. But again, that's been very heavily resisted, and the countries who brought that into their own national law, France being the first of them, all Google did was just remove the text snippets and say, well, no, sorry, not going to pay. So, you know, if they succeed, they will be probably the first country in the world to succeed in this. But time will tell how effective it actually is.
Now, of course, everyone's debating how much the future of work has changed permanently as a result of this pandemic and the impact it's had on how we're working. Obviously, some industries been severely affected, but everyone doing things differently. How much of it will last, and how much of it, Paul, will be people going, oh, God, I can't wait to get back to the office?
Yeah, well, this is fascinating, isn't it? And, you know, obviously, most businesses, most people for that matter, had been moving more and more digital over time. In fact, before this whole COVID thing, I was probably 50-50 with video calling versus face-to-face meeting. Now, obviously, we're in the tech sector, so you'd expect that there would be a bit more than other areas. But, you know, what we're seeing now is every business in the country almost moving to some form of digital delivery or digital operation. And whether that's, you know, communication or storage, or ordering and remote delivery or whatever, that's now become a big part of their business model. So the real question is, what happens when, hopefully soon, but whether it's sooner or later, we move out of lockdown and things go back to some form of new normal? Now, I can't see how, for example, airline travel will ever get back to where it was now that people have got used to using video calls and other tools online. And, you know, I must admit, I've been quite enjoying not having quite as many domestic trips around the country. I love seeing our people around the country, but by the same token, it's actually really effective to be able to use the tools appropriately online. So the question is, what will happen into the future? And, you know, there's some real pros and cons to this whole remote working thing. You know, one of the big advantages, obviously, is the environment, and people certainly made a big point about the fact that, you know, the level of smog in a lot of countries around the world has diminished rapidly. You know, there's less commuting time, less travel time. There are some downsides, though, and one of them, which you touched on at the start there, was the social side. You know, sure, you can be talking to somebody over a video call or have a few people in a video meeting, but it's just not the same as being face-to-face. And, you know, the National Geographic's defined a new thing called the Zoom fatigue. And, you know, what they're basically saying, for example, is that multi-person screens magnify exhaustion. So, you know, if you've spent a day on Zoom meetings, then you do generally feel more tired than you do if you've spent a day in face-to-face meetings. And the reason is that the gallery view, where all meeting participants appear kind of like the Brady Bunch across the screen, and you're constantly sort of glancing from one to the other, kind of overwhelms the brain's, you know, central system, and it spends quite a lot more effort actually decoding that. And often it's a lot harder to actually focus on what's going on. Now, that will probably change as we get more used to it, but it is a real thing. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see where we go. Now, Mary Meeker, she's a technologist and a funder based over in the US, and she's known for really analysing trends that we start to see, you know, across the tech sector, but across the, you know, world as a whole. And she's put out a paper kind of looking at some of this stuff with five sort of key takeaways to it. I know we're running a bit short on time, so I'll race through these very quickly. But, you know, she's saying basically the techie types will have more influence. Now, obviously, we're going to say that's a good thing. Not everyone's going to agree. But it will mean that, you know, there's a greater reliance, again, on those who make the infrastructure and technology work. She sees better work-life balance being a really big thing. And, you know, we've done a few webinars on this. It's a really important thing to make sure that if you are working from home, you can leave your work and actually go and spend time with your family. So geographic spread, even at home, is quite a good thing. But, you know, with less travel and everything, there is better balance there. You know, every company is a digital company now. So, you know, coming back to that point at the start, now that people are selling online, now that people are communicating over video calls and things, why would they go back to doing it the other way? Or why would they not have a combination of the two at least? You know, on-demand is really huge. You know, the gig economy, which is where people, instead of having a full-time job, you know, work on a number of things for a number of different organisations, like might be an Uber driver, for example. And food delivery, you know, and others has really been flourishing through this, and that's likely to lead to longer-term changes as well. And, of course, tech will enable the recovery. You know, we're using the technology now. When we go into this next phase, which is how we recover ourselves economically, technology has got a huge part to play.
It's interesting, isn't it? I do think the enthusiasts think this is it. It's, you know, ground zero, and it's going to be, everything's going to stay permanently this way. And then there are others who line up and point out the downsides. You know, is it great to have your office at home, or does it turn your home into your office 24/7, as you say? I think the thing that will happen is you're just going to see so much more flexibility, aren't you? People are going to do things that work for them, and hopefully we'll be able to do things that work for them.
Yeah, and we've seen this starting to happen over the last sort of 5 years or so anyway, as, you know, a lot of companies are providing that flexibility. I think what this has done is shown that it can actually work. People can work from home. No, it doesn't work for everybody, but people can work from home and be efficient and effective. So, you know, some companies like MBR, you know, they've announced that they're just closing their office, their staff working from home permanently. I think they'll be the exception. I think people will still want to have an office, but there'll be a lot more flexibility in what they do.
We are still humans, after all, aren't we?
Yeah.
I do wonder, though, I was thinking about, and it's a temporary hit, possibly, the co-working. It's a shame in many ways, isn't it, that the co-working spaces are probably going to take a hit for a while, because there was another way of people having the best of both worlds, you know, not forking out for an expensive office, but having some company and a meeting room and a coffee.
Well, that model may well grow significantly, really, because if people are thinking, well, actually, we don't need a permanent office, you know, we can work from home a little bit, then the flexibility that are offered by those types of services is huge.
I imagine they're taking a short-term hit. Yeah, carry on, Paul.
I was going to say one more thing that my daughter's actually told me that I needed to mention was Harry Potter. Online at the moment on harrypotteratHome.com, they're reading out, you've got two people reading out different Harry Potter stories, and Daniel Radcliffe is up next, but we've got Stephen Fry, David Beckham, Dakota Fanning and others who are going to reading them as well. So if your kids are stuck at home and they're getting a little bit bouncing off the walls, then that's a really good option for them as well.
Thanks very much, Paul Matthews.